Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 100. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you Final Mission by John D. MacDonald, narrated by Fred Heimbaugh. John Dan MacDonald was an American writer of novels and short stories, known particularly for his thrillers. Born July 24, 1916, he was a prolific author of crime and suspense novels, many of them set in his adopted home of Florida. His best-known works include the popular and critically acclaimed Travis McGee series and his novel The Executioners, which was adapted into the film Cape Fear. During his writing career, he produced nearly 500 short stories for detective, mystery, adventure, sports, western, and science fiction magazines. Several times, MacDonald's stories were the only ones in an issue of a magazine, but this was hidden by using pseudonyms. He died in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, on December 28, 1986. Fred Heimbaugh is the assistant editor of Protecting Project Pulp, while his roles within the wider District of Wonders have included author, reviewer, narrator, and song producer. His latest song, called Abraham Lincoln Was an Invader from Space, can be found on YouTube, iTunes, and Amazon, and his latest story, Dear Son, was recently published by Everyday Fiction. His life includes a wife, two children, and a series of highly improbable pulp fiction-inspired elements such as corpses in the basement, aliens on the back lawn, and a cat that speaks Latin, which he describes on Facebook and on Twitter under the handle Fredosphere. So prepare to get underway one last time in Final Mission by John D. MacDonald, narrated by Fred Heimbaugh.
From Act 2, Scene 3, Synopsis for Cynthia. Cynthia, distraught, pacing.
Then what are we to do for them? They were here when we needed them. Are they to be surfeited with high honor, served like roast duck at a billion banquets? Tell me, Roger, have we, the living, nothing but boredom to offer those who made this living possible?
Roger, sullenly.
They are old heroes, my dear. The world no longer has need for the heroic impulse. And what is wrong with roast duck?
Cynthia, violently.
Everything.
She crosses to the bed, sits,
posture expressing deep dejection. When she speaks, her voice is soft.
You see, Roger, I am incredibly old. I saw him, you know, that last time we needed them. Oh, what a desperate, bold look about him. Space had put its mark of flame on his hard cheek.
Roger, distantly.
Him? Him, indeed. I hadn't realized that we'd narrowed it to a specific and particular hero. I thought you were bleeding for the whole lot of them.
Cynthia, fondly.
My poor, jealous, darling Roger. Was I to remain suspended and unaware until you came into my life?
Roger, dryly.
More of this hero, please.
Cynthia.
Oh, the look of him, that careful, balanced walk of the spaceman. His eyes were deepest blue, Roger. We thought everything was lost then. He and those like him were our last hope, and such a forlorn one, too.
Roger.
You are turning into a professional sentimentalist, darling. All of them, from those days, are fat-haunched, wheezing old men with long and impossibly boring yarns of the space wars. I see them at the club, you know.
Cynthia, teasingly.
Poor Roger. Let me see. When they left that last time to come back a year later, bringing victory, you must have been all of 4 years old. And I was 17. 17! You should have known me when I was 17.
Roger, come now. Of which puffy old hero are we speaking?
Cynthia, arching her back, speaking boldly.
Can't you tell, you stupid man, which one looks most like my son?
Editorial from the Tampa Times, entitled Ode to the Maladjusted. We look with dubious eye on the psyching programs which are now applied to us early enough to result in a balanced adjustment to the world as we know it. The other day, we wondered what we might be doing were it not for the psyching which has made us such a complacent scribbler of these immortal words. For a moment we thought, with horror, of a neurotic, maladjusted little man full of sighs and dreams and imagery. And then it struck us that many of the men who have come forward in times of stress have been drawn from just such groups. During the space wars, which ended a bare 20 years ago, we would have lost, it is certain. Were it not for men so maladjusted that violence was their creed, brutality their way of life, danger a necessary drug, their very lustiness was our margin of victory. Their names are a heady drumbeat: Crewson, Hallison, Holt, Taine, Kryler, Stake. We know that the possibility of another space war is so remote as to be purest fantasy. With 10,000 planets open to us, mankind will spend 1,000 generations before there is enough surplus energy for war or industrial capacity to divert to armament. Yet, should it happen, we psyched ones are as unsuited for war as is a steer for the bullring. And who will there be to save the scalp of this scribbler next time? From the minutes of the annual meeting of the Tamarack Club. Treasurer. When the heroes of space were given honorary memberships in the Tamarack Club 20 years ago, I do not believe that the members of that period realized that the recipients would make this club their headquarters, and I do not believe that they realized the troublemaking abilities of this group. Our dues are sufficiently high so that we are composed of top executives from industry in this area, all, of course, except those spacemen. The situation constantly grows more serious. During the past month, our losses in club equipment destroyed and damaged were heavy. Mr. I. L. Interman, after being thrown out onto the sidewalk by two of the spacemen, tendered his resignation. There must be an end to this brawling in the Tamarack Club, and an end to those interminable lies they tell in the bar every afternoon. This is a decent club for decent, law-abiding members. It is within our power to rescind their honorary memberships. I doubt whether any one of them has saved the money from his pension in sufficient quantity to pay the initiation fee. Thus, I move that, Chairman,
You have a list of the ones we want to get rid of? There's a couple of them that seem all right to me.
Treasurer. To make any exceptions would defeat the plan. I move that the honorary memberships given 20 years ago to the following men be rescinded. Crewson, Hollison, Holt, Tain, Kryler, Stake, Guthrie, Sterndes, Baranak, Shota, Mendez, Ottonelli, and McGuire. Secretary. Second. Chairman. All in favor? Motion carried. And it is so ordered. Treasurer. Who is going to tell them? Chairman. I'll appoint you. Treasurer. Oh, no, you don't. Not me, brother.
Chairman. You have a suggestion?
Treasurer. See what you think of it. We'll just post a notice on the bulletin board, and underneath it it can say, by order of the executive committee.
Chairman. Yes. Please handle it that way. What's the next order of business?
Memorandum 2. Chief, Psyching Subsection, Federal Bureau of Adult Adjustment, Department of Interior, Septagon Building, New Washington, Nevada, East Hemi. Subject: Disposition of File 8.211J, Retired Commanders of Military Fleet. From Field Director, Special Problem, Team 12. 1. Reference subject file number. The undersigned has taken into adjustment custody the following listed men. The receptivity quotient appears after each name. Crewson, Lawrence A. 0.83. Hollison, Michael X. 0.77. Holt, Brad A. 0.49. Tain, Stanislaus M. 0.60. Kryler, Albert L. 0.83. Stake, Sanders S. 0.44. Guthrie, Sherman B. 0.51. Sterndes, Herman O. 0.66. Baranak, Lewis NMI. 0.76. Shota, Manuel L. 0.41. Mendez, Joaquim G. 0.82. Antonelli, Anthony A. 0.75. McGuire, Sean P. 0.77. 2. It should be noted that receptivity ranges from a low 0.41 to a high of 0.83, with the two highest still short 0.07 of the minimum quotient necessary for the application of mechanical methods of correction. 3. Attention is respectfully directed to the fact that each of the above men draws from the federal government the full pay and allowances of a retired fleet admiral, and thus the problem of handling the situation appears delicate. 4. The attitude of the entire group is consistently scornful, facetious, and uncooperative. It is only with the utmost difficulty that they are persuaded to refrain from giving nonsense answers to the test questions. 5. Subsection procedure in the past, when faced with less important citizens with the same problem, has been to revert to that period in personal history of each person when they were closest to achieving a true and valid adjustment, then recreate the environmental factors. As the period of true adjustment of these men was the time of the last space war, the problems of such environmental recreation become evident. However, as no other approach seems feasible, it is recommended that permission from higher authority be sought
so that this case may be taken out of active files of the subsection. By order of the section chief, Hillary K. Cronin. First Index. 2. Secretary of Interior. From Chief Psyching Subsection, Federal Bureau of Adult Adjustment. Through Chief Federal Bureau of Adult Adjustment. 1. Forwarded recommending approval. John Brown, Chief Psyching Subsection. Second Index. 2. The President of the United States of the Hemisphere Alliance. From the Secretary of the Interior through the Executive Vice President. 1. Forwarded recommending approval and authority. Ellison G. Mortensen, Secretary of the Interior. Third Index. 2. Common CCAP, USSN, through the Secretary of Space. 1. Reference Tri-Screen Conference on Basic Letter, Release Suggested Ship from Stores, Man, Equip, and Launch, Coordinating with Chief, Defensive Propaganda, for Assurance of Friendly Coverage. By order of Morgan Serro, President. And so it was done. The Tampa Bay was one of the cruisers taken out from under wraps, her hull polished and shining, her drives keyed to maximum efficiency. They boarded her, those 13 old men, wheezing at the steepness of the ramp, straining the plastic seams of faded uniforms, while the decorations of nations long dead were brave spots of color against flaccid chests. They boarded her while the cold eyes of the video cameras followed every step, and, as far as the eye could see, the people of Earth, adjusted and content, cheered and waved and wept. See, Angel, that one with the scars, that's Sandy Stake, who won at Rigel. And there's Crosscut Lewis Baranac. He smashed their main fleet off Beetlejuice. Lord, look at them, trying to keep those bellies sucked in and look stern and heroic. Sure, I know. So are dinosaurs. The warning drift of green smoke shows from the blockhouse. The people of the world count slowly. Goodbye. Goodbye. Woom. Adios, muchachos. On the ship, popular vote has put Red Mike Hollison in charge. He sets the constant at 50 lights, makes an assignment list, calls a meeting in the main lounge in officer's country, on this ship where every man is an officer. 13 pairs of somber eyes, unsteady hands, solid dejection. Damn every neat, tidy, well-washed little soul of the universe, Irish McGuire says. Like old shoes, says Spick Mendez, picking his teeth with a thick thumbnail. Mike Hollison sits and waits. There is no hot, sharp anger. Anger is dulled, heavy, hopeless. Then Red Mike speaks. Remember the little fracas on the near side of Antares? Sure, says Manny Shota. You were ready to run when I came into range. The reason I bring it up, says Red Mike, is because I still think I saw a stranger over there. A ship that was a perfect sphere. Red gold, when it picked up the reflection of the jolts we sent at them. After we licked them, the stranger wasn't around. I've always had a notion to go beyond Antares and see what I could find. A dim awakening in dulled eyes. Maybe they'd give us a scrap, Tane says, with a glimmer of hope. We can do one of two things, says Red Mike. We can go along at this speed until there's nobody left to give the last man space burial. Or we can go a-hunting. A lift of heavy heads and a narrowing of the eyes. Hunting? How'd you like to hear a volley off the forward jolt stations again, Sandy? Now you're saying something. Maybe this is a break after all. Red Mike cuts through the babble. Okay, lads, we'll step up the speed and go hunting. Check the armament. See what we'll have to clear away for battle stations if we ever find them out in that haystack of stars. Hop to it. They go out into the corridors leading fore and aft from the lounge. There is a high note of excitement in their voices. Red Mike smiles. At a distance, their voices sound young. That's it. Young. Still smiling, he selects a red apple from one of the big baskets of fruit thoughtfully provided by the membership of the Tamarack Club. He hums at first. Then, his voice muffled by a large bite of apple, he sings hoarsely, "Never die, never die. They only blow away."
That was Final Mission by John D. MacDonald, narrated by Fred Heimbaugh. We had a lot of great suggestions from listeners for what story to run for our centennial episode. I hope no one's too disappointed with the story I finally settled on. For more on why I chose it, and other minutiae of how this podcast works, here's an interview I recorded with our editor, Fred Heimbaugh. So with me on the line here is our stalwart editor, Fred Heimbaugh. Hi, Fred. How are you doing?
Simon, I am well. Good to talk to you.
Likewise. It's been quite a long road for the last 100 or so episodes with a lot of emails going back and forth, but very rarely do I get to hear your voice.
Right.
How do you think we've been going? It's been a remarkable road, and there's been a lot of legwork for you collecting narrations and finding us stories.
Well, I feel like we're in our stride now. When we started, a little backstory that you missed out on was that Tony was recruiting us and creating this podcast as part of the District of Wonders, and I had absolutely no claim whatsoever to any kind of expertise in pulp fiction, but I was very, very excited and flattered that he asked me to edit it. So, and he gave us just a very few months, couple months or so, to put together 30 recorded shows because he wanted us to have a buffer of that size. And so I had an enormous amount of reading to do right off the bat, and we really cranked out those shows like crazy. By comparison to that, every day in Protecting Project Pulp seems like a frolic in the meadow.
Terrific. Yeah, I think that was the pattern for all of the New District of Wonders shows. Tony had this idea that one way that we could not fail horribly is to not burn through a bunch of a short list of stories and then have no content. So
yeah.
He felt that he could protect us from our own incompetence a little bit by at least mandating that.
Yeah, Tony's style is different than mine, but he manages to be incredibly productive in his dive right in approach, and so I cannot fault him for that.
Absolutely. I'm really hoping to get him on the show in the next couple of weeks and talk to him about that. It's astounding that he is able to keep starting projects like this and have so much success with so many of them. He's one of the most prolific people I know in terms of podcasting and diverse things like soap.
Soap making, yes. That's exactly what I was thinking. Now, you came in, somewhere in the middle here, somewhere around episode 50, or I don't remember the number.
31.
Earlier.
It was quite a ways back. But it was definitely 15, 20 episodes before I really found my feet and had a sense of what the day-to-day of it would be. I had some pretty crazy ideas right at the start, and then we managed to settle into something that was a bit more maintainable, sustainable.
Right. Now, how do you know Tony, and how did remind us of your various contacts and the ways you participated, for example, in Starship Sofa?
Well, when I was living in the Netherlands for 2 years, I had quite a substantial commute, so I got into a lot of different podcasts, and beyond Escape Pod, Starship Sofa was one of the main ones that occupied me for that time, and I very quickly found that it was something that I really wanted to contribute to, so I started badgering Tony about letting me do some narrations, and so I've read several stories, and I've even done a regular column, well, semi-regular, called Gaming the Future, about games and science fiction. And yeah, just anything it seemed like I could help out with around the place. I tried doing an Android app for the show and all sorts of different things. And the wonderful thing working with Tony is just that, he's very much accepting of anyone who's willing to step up and contribute. The door is always open if you've got an idea or if there's a spot for you in one of his crazy schemes.
Yeah, I didn't know about the Android app. I happened to be my toe in the door was by way of being one of the very first fans of the Starship Sofa show, who would email them regularly every week after. As soon as I heard the episode, I would have something I'd contribute. And those days it was Tony and Kieran.
Kieran, yeah.
Sitting on the couch discussing sci-fi. That was the format of the show in the early days. And there would always be something I'd want to say. And they were, just knew. They had no idea where the show was going to go. And they would read my email every week, so I became a regular contributor that way. And then things just went on from there. I started doing narrations. I was the graphic novel reviewer for a while, and that was another job in which I had very little prior qualifications. But you say, Tony loves to include. He'll welcome anybody who wants to contribute.
Yeah, one of the high points was when a song from you would turn up periodically. I thought that was always Tony's always been excited to have anything sort of sci-fi connect with the Starship Sofa if you could find a way to slot it in. And Abraham Lincoln was an invader from space. I thought that just tickled me enormously. So,
well, thanks. I'm glad you mentioned that. I would like to get back into doing some more recording of music. I'd like to take things to a higher level in terms of the production values, which is something I've always neglected. But I have been focusing on writing fiction for the last 8 months or so. I did NaNoWriMo back in November of 2013, and so I'm still recovering from the repercussions of that. And but I will get back to the music eventually.
Awesome. It is a great conduit for connecting with really interesting creative people. I think Tony's just found that as news of the sofa spreads, it just brings really interesting people. I mean, Cory Doctorow's regularly resharing bits of the show or news related to the show on Boing Boing. And there was a podcast, a Kickstarter recently that that Tony was kind of drumming up with, was it Alan Datlow? No. There's a remarkable suite of creative people, like David Brin and various others, who I feel like I've got to sort of reach out to in a way that I would never get a chance to talk to. Like, I was emailing David Brin while I was recording one of his stories, asking him for pronunciation tips, and I would never have an excuse to email David Brin otherwise. So that was quite exciting.
Yeah, that's good. It seems to me that listeners, particularly those who have joined the show somewhat recently, might be interested in hearing some of the stories that you've hosted that you thought were particularly good. Yeah. My favorite story goes all the way back to the first couple months. It was show number 4, mm-hmm. which is before your time, Croom, Son of the Sea by Valentine Wood.
Yes.
And you remember that one? You know about Croom?
Yeah, no, I made sure that I'd listened to all the previous episodes before stepping in so that
I could
not sound like a complete crazy person.
Yeah, congratulate. Well done on that, yeah. Croom, for those who don't remember it or didn't hear it, is essentially Tarzan with sharks. And he's blonde-haired, blue-eyed young man who is lost at sea and ends up living with a bunch of South Pacific Islanders on this kind of isolated lagoon that's surrounded by mountains, and it's complicated how he ended up there. But anyway, so it's this white boy raised by the natives, and now he has to single-handedly kill the shark to save his little village there. And the descriptions are wonderful, and the fight scenes but it's got that coming of age angle. It's nice because it's like Tarzan without the racism, which is something I think most everybody could appreciate. And it really taps into, I think, an enduring question that people living in any kind of civilized men, who are, of course, the audience for Pulp Fiction, mm-hmm. tends to be blue-collar men. And they're sitting there asking themselves, if I were in a completely uncivilized, primitive environment, could I hack it? Would I survive the test? And that's the question that is raised in a story like Croom. And that's why it really grabbed me.
Yeah, I think there was definitely a very strong theme of putting yourself into those stories, and for various reasons, because you wanted to be kissing a Martian princess, or because you really wanted to wonder if you could hack it in the Wild West or on some tropical island that you've been dashed up against when your schooner is smashed or something. I think that's a core thing for all pulp, is a strong vein of putting yourself into those stories. That's why there's so often a fairly regular Joe kind of guy in those stories that's an easy place to slot yourself in. Right. Although he does tend to be a bit more capable and a bit more savvy than a regular Joe.
Yes.
Yeah. For me, I'm so focused on the narrators that we get, and that's such a big part of that really makes or breaks a story for me. when you've got the likes of Nick Cam
or, yes.
or Josie Babin or Brandy Tarvin or any of these, those are stories that I tend to really enjoy. I think Logan Waterman has just had him on a recent episode and just blew it out of the water again every time. And you know, Nick Cam doing Shadows in the Moonlight and all of those. I find I can enjoy all the different subgenres equally, and it's really how strong the narration is that shapes how much I enjoy it. I think that's why, for me, when I started doing the show, it was important for me to sort of put the narrators a bit further up the running sheet, make them a little bit more visible.
I see.
Because the work that they do, the contribution that they make is so immediate and so important to our success, I think.
For those who may want to look up Logan Waterman, and the narrators always show up in the tags so that you can search the website, look at the list of tags and search their name that way. But, for example, last week's show, 99, Logan narrated The Avalanche Maker by W. Ryerson Johnson, who is better known as the author of some of the Doc Savage novels.
Mm.
And he read The Experiment in Gyro Hats, number 32.
Yeah.
And there was one more, too. There was The Crystal Ray, that was 35.
Yep.
Both of those are, I don't know why I gave him, in those cases, old school sci-fi, you know, Gizmo and Gee Whiz, highly speculative technology type stories in both of those.
Yeah, I was really pleased by the way he pulled those off, the way he, particularly with the experiment with gyro hats, he managed to take
something. Which is crazy. That's a crazy story.
It really is. It's just, yeah, it's played quite straight as well. And that just makes it, I love that style. That really endeared me to him when he managed to deliver that so well.
Yeah. Well, another episode which particularly sticks in my mind is number 14, where we got a story from Tim Powers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a part of our very occasional effort to promote living authors who are working in a contemporary way to, but in some way or other are connected to the Pulp Fiction era. And we also interviewed Tim Powers. If anyone who's not heard that, episode 14 really ought to go listen to that interview. And he was such a good sport, willing to give us a story. The story is The Way Down the Hill, which is very hair-raising. It's got immortals. Anyway, Tim absolutely did not shy away from the Pulp Fiction label. And he embraced it utterly. And that's what really endeared him to me. The story, The Way Down the Hill, the question came up, well, why is The Way Down the Hill Pulp Fiction? Or is it? And I said, well, it's got immortals. It's got a robot. And it's got a body in a box. And then Tim Powers added one more element, which I thought was really interesting insight, which is that in terms of the robot, which is appears as a human being, it's a convincing android.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, that story is utterly uninterested in the question of how you would pull that off technologically. It just is interested in a lifelike robot, plopping it into the story and see how the characters react to it. And so the complete absence of anything resembling hard science fiction is absolutely central to the Pulp Fiction sensibility. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly a really good way to put it. So I would definitely recommend people going back and listening to that episode.
Yeah, I enjoyed that story tremendously. Who did we get to narrate that?
Well, I did it. So the story really stuck in my mind. As I was practicing that story, I kept getting choked up. The emotion was just overwhelming me. It's not a particularly emotional story, except it just has this extremely tragic, very serious ending, where these people who live forever are starting to confront the utter selfishness and emptiness of their existence.
It's kind of the pathos of the vampire kind of thing.
Oh yes, that's a really good point.
And that's the bit that really sticks in my mind from the way that that story plays out, is that real sense of, but you know, we just keep going on, and there's always going to be more. And at some point, any of these characters is probably going to crack in some way and just decide that they have to stop or change or do something.
Yes.
Yeah. And speaking of your narrations, this will be going out around episode 100, for which we have Final Mission narrated by you. How did you find that?
I was surprised that you picked that for the 100th episode, because it is a little bit experimental in the literary style. It's all chopped up. It's quoting official documents. It's you're dropped into the middle of conversations where there's no explanation of who's talking to whom. I was a little hesitant to pick that story because it's just not very typical for pulp. I thought, though, it was a very interesting story. It made for an interesting time as the narrator. And, of course, the theme of the story taps into the question of heroism. What is modern life compatible, or will it make accommodation for the manly, heroic lifestyle? And I think that's a continuing preoccupation in pulp fiction.
I kind of like this story as a quirky choice for episode 100, because it's quite reflective on the sorts of narratives that happen in pulp. So we often have the adventure in the pulp story, but this is kind of what would happen after the adventure.
Yes.
And I also felt that we were getting quite quite old after 100 episodes. That seems like
a remarkable identify thing. With the...
Yeah, but hopefully we won't be quite going on our final mission yet.
Not quite yet.
But yeah, so I thought it had some connections with the 100th episode. But yeah, it's not like there was definitely more traditional choices that were available. But yeah.
Yeah, some of our most dedicated fans have been debating on the website in the comments on what authors they would like to hear, and so I hope they are not terribly disappointed. They were some of the most classic authors were mentioned.
Yeah, was it Seabury Quinn and someone else?
Yeah, that was one of them.
Mm.
A listener, Roland, was hoping for a Jules de Grandin story.
Mm-hmm.
Solomon Grundy.
Yes.
Was hoping for C.L. Moore.
Mm.
Roland also was wondering about Seabury Quinn, Henry Kuttner, Ernst Bloch, or E. Howard Price, which are all fabulous suggestions. Now, yeah. Listeners should be aware that we are constrained by the need for, generally speaking, by the need for public domain stories. In the past, too, I've shied away from stories that get more than an hour long. Well, more recently, we've tried longer stories, either in one gulp or splitting them up into two or three parts. We did the Amazon... Black Amazon of Mars by really my first choice, which is Lee Brackett. And that went three parts. That was a 3-hour story. 25,000 words. That's really getting into novella territory.
That really blew my mind when I saw that you'd recorded all of that, because that's a heroic effort.
Well, there aren't many authors I would be excited about doing that for, but Lee Brackett, definitely. Her descriptions and the elemental nature of the action in her stories just absolutely keeps me coming back.
Speaking of heroic narrations, did you hear Nick Cam doing, I think it's House on the Borderlands on Tales to Terrify, the William Hope Hodgson story?
No, I haven't heard that. I will go and look that up, though. Nick is, yes, of course, a true pro in every sense, yeah, of the word. Yeah, and yeah, he is really a kind of... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, that was one of the reasons I had to jump on that one, was just to hear him read a story like that. That was a remarkable effort from Nick on Tales to Terrify. And I don't get a lot of time to reach out to the other District of Wonders hosts, but I definitely need to drop my thanks across for that one.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's just about everything. Was there anything else that you thought of for our centennial? Apart from, we're excited to be back here in at episode 200.
Well, yeah, hopefully we'll still be here. And I think that pretty much covers everything.
Cool. Well, Fred, thanks a lot for coming on the show. And we all appreciate the heroic work you do keeping us stocked with stories and narrations.
Well, thank you, Simon. And it's a pleasure working with you and Tom. And hopefully we'll hear from Tom also. Give him a chance to say hi to everyone at some point in the future, and maybe bring Dave Robison back for a short reunion. That would be a lot of fun.
I think it would. I'll definitely be pushing for that in the next episode or two. Terrific. Well, I'll talk to you later.
So long.
Over the next few weeks, I'm hoping to interview the other people who've helped get PPP this far, and I'd love to hear suggestions for questions in the comments. Leave a comment on our site at protectingprojectpulp.com, or by joining the conversation in the District of Wonders forum, linked from the site menu. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click the subscribe link. Thanks for listening from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrand. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 101, where we'll bring you The Weight of Reputation by Harrison R. Ford. Here's to another 100 episodes of fantastic fiction, and have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.